Good morning, all. With pleasure, I'm introducing Paul King, that is going to speak about working with databases and Groovy. I remember you that at the end of the session, you can have a question time, and Paul King is available for questions, 5 or 10 minutes.
Welcome, everyone. So I'm Paul King. I'm one of the committers of Groovy, on the Actions PMC committee for Groovy. I tend to wear quite a few different hats.
The red light's on. But...
I have to start up. Try now.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yes or no at the back? Can you hear me? One of the things I'm delighted about is that Object Computing Inc., so OCI in the US, who are one of the big proponents behind the browser framework, sponsoring some of my time.
Speak with this because that's not it. It's not working.
Not working very well? Okay. And they're now sponsoring me for some of my time to work on Groovy, so that's great. What I'm going to talk about mostly today is fairly well understood value add that Groovy puts on top of the JDBC APIs. And I'm going to briefly look at some NoSQL options at the end, but it's not a tutorial on those NoSQL options. It's just to give you a flavor that all this relational database stuff that I'm telling you about is not the only option you have available. So who's used Groovy before in the room? Not very many people. Okay, well, I had a bit of an intro talk just before. I don't know if any of you were at that, but I've got only a very small number of slides telling a little bit about Groovy, but I don't want to spend much of this talk on that. So it's not super important that you understand every single line of Groovy that you see later on. It's very easy to learn. If you're familiar with Java, you'd pick it up very quickly. But if you're thinking of Groovy, you can think of it as a super version of Java. So think of Java, think of all the things that you hate, extra boilerplate, specifying things multiple times, telling it, the compiler, what the type of this thing is several times, putting in all this generic type information, all the square brackets make your eyes water or whatever. So take all that away, but we can still have strong typing if we want through type inference. When we want to, take the painful stuff away and add in first-class functional programming, an extensible type system, metaprogramming, and a range of other features, and that's what Groovy is. Just one slide to show you some examples of Groovy. The first line is the kind of thing you'd see in a Hello World Java program, system.out println and a string, Hello World. You can do the same thing in Groovy, that's fine. Or you can leave off a bit of the noise and just go print line hello world if you want. Okay, the second example has a explicit type for the variable called name, and we're assigning it a string. And then we're going to print it out using what's called a gstring, which is string interpolation, Groovy string. And we've got a string and we put $name and that gets interpolated, and the Guillaume, the project leader of Groovy's name, will get put into that string. We can have multi-line strings, and they can be interpolated or not. There's the arithmetic in Groovy is designed to be friendly to the financial community. So in most languages, if you go assert 0.5 equals a half, it won't say true. So due to vagaries of rounding and sorts of things, it won't work. Similarly, assert 0.1 plus 0.2 equals 0.3. In many languages, that won't work either. In Groovy, it'll do all the right things. Here, we're defining a method. We happen to be trying to call the size method on the argument, the size method on the object, which is the argument of this print size method. And we can do safe navigation and things like that. So if object happens to be null, this whole expression will be null. So there's a few little nice things like that. this is duck typing in action. So I didn't bother specifying the type of the argument object here. So this could be a list, and I'll get the size of the list. It could be a string, I'll get the size of the string. It could be your domain object, shopping cart, and I'll get the size of the shopping cart, whatever that might mean, number of items in the shopping cart or something. Here's an example. I'm defining a pets variable, which happens to be a list of strings. And if I was going to process this in Java, I'd probably have a for loop or something. You can certainly do that in Groovy if you want, but a more typical way is pets.each. What that'll do is iterate through each of the things in this pets list, and for each of those things, it'll run this bit of code in between the curly braces, and what that's going to do in our case is assert that the each individual pet, so an ant, a bee, and a cat, comes before a dog in the alphabet lexicographically. Does that all make sense? Feel free to ask me questions as we go along. I can speed up at the end if I'm running behind time. I prefer you to all follow along as we go. So I don't have any more tutorial stuff on Groovy. Does that sort of give you a flavour of some of the parts of it? Okay, that's good. I've got plenty of other material if you need to ask anything. So the bulk of what this talk's going to be is now looking at the SQL class that's built into Groovy. And a little bit of time looking at data sets, which is a poor man's ORM, Object Relational Management System, that can sit on top of the Groovy SQL class. And then a glimpse at document and graph-oriented databases. Not to try to give you a complete tutorial on those. They're big topics in themselves, but just to show you a flavour of different kinds of things that are possible. Yep, you're right. So the SQL class is just a single class. It's got some helper utilities and things, but a single class that comes with Groovy that's just a layer on top of JDBC, and it just makes writing JDBC code a lot simpler. So how do you connect to a database? You call new instance method. There's a few different variants, but that's the typical thing you would do. You'd pass in the URL. You'd pass in the driver if you didn't have a default driver. And if your password has a username and password, you'd pass those in as well. In the simplest case, you can just pass in the URL. That'll now give you a SQL instance that lets you interact with the database in a very concise way. When you're finished doing everything, you call sql.close. Okay. This code is assuming that the driver, in our case, we've got hsqldb, assuming that's on the class path. Okay. There is a map-based variant of new instance. So instead of calling it with 4 or 2 or 1 parameter or whatever, 3, I think there's 1, 2, 3, and 4 variants. Instead of calling it that way, you can call it with the map-based arguments. And this lets you set any of the setters that are also on the SQL class all in one go. So there happens to be ways to set where the caching, whether you're going to cache statements, what concurrency level your result sets are going to be using, and so on. You can do all of that in one go, and this can actually be put into a properties file. So it can be made. That's one useful thing for that particular style. One of the things that you can also do is put grab statements. If you've just got a little script, and we've actually found this particular feature very useful. So in some of my customer sites, they're kind of very traditional customers, and they'll have a DBA department, and the DBA department they're the only ones that'll have control over the servers that the databases are running on, et cetera, et cetera, and they'll set it all up for you. And quite often we'll be interacting with them and we'll say, oh, hey, that database you were going to set up for me is not working yet, and they'll say, yes, I've set it all up, it's definitely working, blah, blah. And what we'll do is we'll just send them a little Groovy script. We've gone in and installed the Groovy console on their machines before, and it'll have these grab statements in it. We actually, for that particular customer, we actually go and reference their internal repo, because you can't get to the outside world from their machines. But we can just email this little script. It's got the grab statements inside it, and the DBA runs our script. And they can see, oh, yes, it doesn't work. And then we often get this email saying, oh, yeah, sorry about that. We forgot to let it through the firewall or whatever the particular case may be, or forgot to turn permissions on. So having grab statements in your script is kind of a useful thing sometimes. If you've got a Maven or Gradle build system, you won't need your dependencies on drivers and things will be specified in another way. You won't need to see things like that. Another variant, instead of new instance, you can use with instance everywhere. And there's variants for the kind of variants we saw. And in that case, you'll have closure code in a bunch of code inside where you're using the SQL instance, and you don't need to do the close explicitly. It'll automatically close it. There is an alternative mechanism if you want to use a data source instead of the traditional SQL connection mechanism, then you can create a new data source, and instead of using a new instance factory sort of method, you just use the constructor of the SQL class. So new SQL, pass in your data source, and you'll get the same sort of thing. Now, we're still, Java 9, with its jigsaw modularity, is throwing a whole spanner in the works for many languages, some of Java, but many of the alternative languages and libraries, and this may end up being the only way to get access to databases once we start using Java 9. We're still working our way through that. But we've got all the options available there at the moment, and we'll progress that as we go. Okay, so in this particular case, I'm using connection pooling. So connection pooling happens to be a data source, makes itself available as a data source, and this just happens to be using it. I think I just wanted to show another Apache project in one of my slides. So, and typically, you might have your own pooling mechanism that you're using if you're talking to some sort of app server or whatever. There'll be some sort of pooling thing there, and you can make use of that. Okay, now, once you have it, the most common thing that you'll typically want to do is read from it. Because I want to have all these slides being self-contained, so you can run along and there's a GitHub site that has all of the code for this, and there's SlideShare that has all the slides, so you don't need to frantically copy anything. If you're wanting to follow along, you can't really read much from a database until you write into it. So I've switched the order in which I'd normally present this to you so that we can put some stuff in a database and then it'll be there once we will start to read. So we're going to look at writing to the database, and the first thing I want to do is actually create a new table in my database instance, and then we're going to populate it. So here is some DDL code, basically some SQL code here that creates a table with certain columns, first name and last name, varchars and things. It happens to have some HSQLDB, happens to support an ID, automatically creates an ID for us, and it happens to be using that, but that's not really relevant for us right here. It's the key to our columns. Once you go and execute that, so how do I execute that? That's just a string, multi-line string, and we just go execute, and we just execute the string. So that's it. There's nothing more than that. Now I can insert into the database, just again, executing a string, and insert into athlete, first name, last name, date of birth, the IDs auto-populated, values, Paul, to chat, 1969. Does anyone know, does that name ring a bell for anyone? Does anyone know what my data types are here? It's working, I don't need that. Excellent. Does that ring a bell? Do you know history of it happens to be a sporting example. Still doesn't ring a bell. Marathons. So it's world record marathon runs is where this data comes from. So in 1969, Paul Turgette, I don't know how to pronounce it properly perhaps, created a world record in when he ran the marathon. We'll see some more data pop up. That's just where it comes from. It's not important. I'm not in the list, don't worry. Okay. Oh, no, actually, no, that's just his date of birth, is it? Yeah, that's his date of birth. Later on, we'll see when he did the work records. So here's some more examples. So one of the things that often becomes obscure, well, first off, here I'm hard-coding. This just happens to be a string with hard-coded values inside it. That's not very useful, typically. So what I want to do is find ways in which I can poke in the values. And there's a couple of different ways. I can just, when I call execute, I can just have a list of parameters. Now, depending on where I pull those parameters from, and I could do string concatenation to put them together. Would anyone see any potential issues if I wasn't a bit careful in how I did that?
SQL injection.
Yeah, SQL injection. So if I have a website and I'm getting people's names from the website, you know, entering the name and I'll tell you their birth date or when they did the world record, and someone enters the name but then adds in a bunch of SQL code, if I'm a bit lax in how I concatenate my strings together, I'm going to be subject to SQL injection and someone can get into my database and hack it to pieces. So I'm not going to show you any examples that are subject to SQL injection. So here, what it looks like, I've just got a string. This is an interpolated string, a groovy string, G string. And where you see the dollar, I'm going to start putting things in. Here I've got data coming from a map. It's a map with key first and value, Khalid, key last, Kanuchi, and so on. And into my database, I'm going to put data.first, data.last, data.birth. Again, because the definition of this map here is under my control in my code, it's not going to be a problem. But if this happened to come off a web form and someone put SQL code in there, potentially this would cause havoc. But the smart thing about this is Groovy knows that this is a G-string, an interpolated string, and it'll convert this string underneath the covers into what we're going to see later on, and it's not going to be subject to SQL injection. Okay, so this is a preferred way to do it, and the nice thing about this, when we look at the other examples, you can see that you can just add in parameters here, which I'll talk about shortly. Sometimes it's a little bit hard to work out, here's some parameters, and which of the question marks belong to which parameters? And it's a bit obscure. When I'm using the G-string variant, I know exactly what's going in each of the places, so I can make sure they're lined up and not out of order and so on. So this is generally the preferred way of doing things when you're using Groovy's SQL class. Now, if you want to do it longhand, you can, and this is the longhand way that this gets converted into. But it's also doing one other... It's doing two things on one slide. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. So here I'm doing an execute. Here I'm doing an execute insert, which is a very slightly different class, and I'm doing it longhand. And I'll tell you what the two differences are. The fact that I'm doing it longhand, it just means instead of using the dollar placeholders here, I put question marks in my query, and then I just put a bunch of parameters on the end. So that's just a different style. You can pick whichever of those you prefer. Now, the difference between execute and execute inserts is if I happen to know that the SQL that I'm running is inserting into the database, then I can use execute insert instead of execute, and if there's an auto-generated key, I'll get that back. And that could be handy rather than having to do another query to pull that back. Okay? So in this case here, I'm going to pull back the key, and it'll tell me that I've got two keys. It'll tell me that the key for the first row that I inserted actually has ID 2, which that's just a quirk of this particular database. The first row allocate in its auto-generated IDs, that's just what comes back. Now, there's another, as well as SQL insert, there's an update variant as well. If I know that the SQL query that I'm executing updates the database. I can use execute update instead of execute. And in that case, it'll return the number of rows that got updated, if any. So if nothing got updated, if there's a where last name equals something that's not there, nothing will get updated, it'll come back with zero. So if I want to check that I'm expecting to change three rows, I can check later that, yes, three rows got changed, all's good. Okay, now going through the CRUD methods, create, read, update, delete. Read's the one you're going to use most. We're going to do that last. We've done creates. We've done updates now. I'm going to show you delete, just because it fits on the slide here. We can just throw it in as SQL code. Delete from athlete. So that's fine. Now we're going to go to reading. And this is the one you're going to be doing most of. And we can spend a bit of time on the different variants that are available. Now, I said at the start that Groovy's SQL class is a layer that's above JDBC. The first thing that Groovy exposes is just a very thin layer on that JDBC class, and that's it returns back the result sets. It's just a slightly wrapped result set, a very light layer on top of the JDBC API, and that's the query method returns that. Okay. This is what you'd probably use query if you've got very, very large data sets and you're wanting to step through them yourself manually and potentially after you've got some data that you're interested in, not progress going through the data. If you use something like SQL.eachRow, it's going to progress through all of the rows in that table, or all the rows in the result set that comes back from your query. In this case here, I'm selecting first name and last name from athlete, and I'm going to print out the names. So when the result sets come back, this one's a thin layer. It's kind of the result set. You can use get string, which these are things out of the JDBC API, and you can use an ordinal value to say column number. Or you can use a named variable. If you start using all the other methods apart from query, put an extra layer on top of the results that comes back. It turns it into a Groovy row result, which lets you use Groovy's normal shorthands. So I can go row 0 instead of get string 1. The index has changed, but Groovy. JDBC indexes from 1, normal lists in Java index from 0, so once you get to this layer, it uses all the normal indexes that Java would use. And last name, this is case insensitive. You can use it like a normal property. Okay. If you don't want all the... if you don't want to process each row and just want maybe the first one, you can use first row. Now, the thing that comes back, it's what's called a Groovy row result. It happens to be a normal map as well. So anywhere in your code that you're expecting to be using maps, you can just pass that result to. So if you've got a utility method that converts a map to JSON, you can just query the database, throw this to the utility method, and you'll get a JSON equivalent of your class, whatever. So the data types that Groovy has incorporated into its layer are very friendly data types. And they do things like case-insensitive querying, so you can do dot first name in capitals. You can go -1 to get the last column, so you can get columns from the right or from the left, which are some of the features that Groovy normally provides for normal collection style collections as well, lists and so on. Now, as well as first row, which just gets the first one, you can get all the rows. And this gets all the rows in one go. So you've now got in memory all of your rows. So you don't necessarily want to do this if you've got a huge volume of data here, but if you're going to be processing, if you've got a reasonable size amount of data and you're going to be doing lots of processing on it, it's handy to have it all in memory. And this just goes and gets it, and then you've got it all. And we're just going to collect them and join them and so on. Now, you can actually, as well as getting result sets back, you can get scalar values as well. This is just an example of how you might get the number of rows from a particular query. Okay, so there's three athletes, select count star. Okay, I want to quickly swap over to stored procedures. So this is the wonderful thing about SQL being a standard. It gives us a standard way of doing stored procedures, and it happens to be different for nearly every database, but anyway, the wonderful thing about standards. This is how you can create, this is what we're going to do to motivate why we want to use our stored procedures is just slightly extend we're going to create a second table, and there'll be an index between the two tables. So we're going to keep our athlete table that we had before, which had first name, last name, date of birth. Now we're going to start capturing the world record runs. So when they won a marathon in world record time, we're going to go and start populating this as well. Okay, so I don't know why you'd want to necessarily capture the distance of a marathon. It's always the same, but you'll want to capture the time, venue, and other information. Now, I showed you before how you do the inserts. What I've gone and done is created a little helper method with the code we had in the previous slides, and now I'm going to call that helper method insert run insert athlete, and that's typically how you'd refactor code if you were in Groovy anyway. So let's assume we're going to do that. So we've now got three athletes and four runs. Okay. Now we can get to the point of creating a stored procedure. So for our HSQL database, there's a few different variants that we have, but in this case here, we're going to create a stored procedure that's basically, in some ways, acting a little bit like a view. And what it's going to do is select a particular athlete, information about the athlete and about a run all in one go. So it's going to go and select from the two tables particular bits of information that we're interested in and make sure the keys line up. And order by as well, and that's just going to be select athlete run. That's going to be a stored procedure. That's now stored away in the database. And we've got our SQL class that we created, instance we created before, and we can just go if the stored procedure happens to be a function like this one is, and it's returning a result set or returning a scalar value, we go and use all the methods we saw before. Each row, rows, first row. But instead of just being select star from or insert or whatever, we now do call and we call our function. Okay, this one here doesn't take any parameters. We'll see some more things about parameters in a minute. This is going to return all of them. So yeah, okay. So that's because we only had four runs, we'll get those four that came out, and it's got the last name of the runner, and then the venue, and then the date. Now let's have a look at if we have a parameter. Now there's a few different variations for this as well. Here we're going to create a different stored procedure, and this one has got a single parameter last name, that's a varchar. Okay, the details of what's in that stored procedure aren't really important to us. But it also happens to be a function, so it's actually returning a scalar value in this particular. It's just returning an answer. It's not a result set. It's just a single scalar value. And so we call first row. Now we can use placeholders like we saw in some of our previous examples. Here we can have a placeholder that's the return value, and there's a placeholder for the argument. Okay. So what this placeholder as the return value means is this whole statement will return whatever that stored function returns. And this placeholder here is our parameter. So that's the surname of the athlete that we're interested in. Okay. Now this little zero here is, this thing here is potentially could have multiple columns, and we're just getting the first one. In our particular case, it's not going to have multiple things, but it comes back as a list with a single thing inside it. Now, so that's an example where we've just got a function returning a single thing with a single parameter. In general, SQL stored procedures can potentially have multiple input and output parameters. Now, how is this handled? So now, instead of, if you want to do these more elaborate scenarios that are going to potentially handle in-out parameters, you don't use the normal SQL methods that we were calling before, first row, rows, query, each row. Instead, you use a special call method. Now, this knows that it's going to a stored procedure, and it's a richer API that lets us specify typing information. Okay. If you recall, if you've ever done this at the JDBC level, you have to start doing get string, get integer, get what, or get, you have to start, when you're querying back from the database, you have to start using specific parts of the JDBC API to get stuff back. Now, we don't want to expose that to the user, and in the general case, and we could try to infer that in many cases, but in the general case, we might get it wrong. So what we do is we put the burden on whoever's using the API to tell us what the types are, and we call the right methods underneath the covers. So that's why you have to use this special call method. Otherwise, it's going to, apart from that one difference, it's going to end up doing the same thing. And so in this case here, what we say is this placeholder is going to be an out parameter. It could be an in-out, or in this case, it's an out. So this parameter is an out parameter. So what for an out parameter, what we're going to do is, in the list of parameters, we're going to supply the type of the thing we're expecting to get back. And in our case, it's going to be a varchar. And these other two are both in parameters, so we just feed in the parameters. Okay. Now inside this call statement, when you execute this, the result of doing this call will be fed into this closure as the parameter full name here, and this is what we've called it, and so we can assert the full name is that. Does that make sense? And so you could potentially have multiple in-out parameters or out parameters, and then you'll have multiple of these things appearing. So some other things that you might want to do is get access to the metadata. Okay, so has anyone used any of the metadata facilities in JDBC? Yep. It's fairly straightforward, and you can just call the same sort of things that you'd call in the JDBC API, get metadata on a result set, and that gets forwarded through automatically, get column labels and things like that. I don't want to dwell on this one. We've got more important slides to get onto. Similar example here. Now, using metadata happens to be something that's a reasonably common thing to want to do. And so as well as the normal JDBC style way of getting it, just by calling get metadata on the result sets, Groovy provides an additional variant of most of the methods. So each row, as well as taking a... So in previous examples, when I showed each row, I did my query, select star from whatever, and then I had a bit of code that's after it, which was a closure. Groovy lets you pass that closure in just as a parameter if you want. So here I'm doing select star from a table name. Here's the closure that's actually going to process... this actually print row is going to process all the rows, which is this one here. I'm going to print them out as I saw before. But this variant has an additional parameter, which is another closure. And this closure actually works on the metadata. So turns out that this variant is just a bit of syntactic sugar that makes it easier to work with the metadata. So that's there if you ever need it. If you need to paginate your data, so you've got huge volumes of data and you're presenting it on a web page, you can let the API deal with that for you. So SQL.rows, you can pass in starting at index 1 or 5 or 9, give me the next 4. Okay, and that'll now step down through my list of marathon runners and get 4 at a time. As well as splitting things up, we can combine things together. So here, within a single transaction, we're going to insert 2 athletes. Okay, so either both of those athletes will get inserted or none, because it'll be transactional. I can do things in batching. You do this for efficiency. So again, we're going to do a whole bunch of inserts, but rather than having each, we might have 10,000 of these, instead of each of these going via JDBC in a single interaction for each row, we can keep adding things to a batch and then send the batch all in one go. And there's variants of that for ad hoc queries. So here we've got 2 different queries and we're just putting 2 different queries into a batch and sending that. Here we're going to be using a prepared statement. Remember I talked about plugging in the automatically plugging in the variables so we don't get SQL injection. That's the standard. That happens automatically. Groovy does it the nice way by default. And so here we've got a particular... If we pass in a query here, we'll automatically have a prepared statement that we can just add batch twos, and then it'll go and send that away. We won't know that it's going in batches. We'll just keep adding to it. But if you turn on logging, you'll see that here I've actually set a batch size of 3, which normally you wouldn't need a batch size that small. But I just wanted to show that after 3 of these executed, it sent a batch across to the database, and then it did a couple more and sent another batch. Now, there is some, as I said before, the preferred way of writing your queries was to use the G-strings, interpolated strings. If you don't want to use that particular style, there's other variants open to you. So there's named parameters, there's ordinal parameters and named ordinal parameters. So what's all that mean? Basically, instead of having the dollars, which is interpolated G-strings, you put question mark dot first and question mark dot last and so on. That'll then assume instead of for each question mark having a parameter here, it'll assume you've got 1 parameter and it'll look at the first property of whatever that is, the last property, the date of birth. Now, this could be just a map or it could be one of your domain classes, right? You can do, here I've got 2 parameters, so I can again get to different things from the different parameters. I can use, instead of question mark dot first, I can use colon first, colon last, colon date of birth for this first example. You can't, there's no number variant for this one. And that's all I need to tell about that. Now, why would you ever use these? If you've got a normal Groovy class and you're using the G-strings, you don't ever need to use these. These come about if you perhaps had a templating language or something, or you're calling this from Java. If I'm calling this from Java, it's a pain to create G-strings. A G-string is just a Java class. And you can create one and populate its fields and so on, but Java doesn't give you a nice syntax to do that, as Groovy would. So what it means is you can just throw the Groovy library in your Java class path, and then from Java, you can access all of these features in your queries using the normal JDBC API. Oh no, you can still do some of this stuff, and it'll let you get to that mechanism. So if you're stuck in the Java world and you're still trying to use the SQL library as an API, you can do bits of this. Okay. Now we're going to move up the stack a little bit now, and talk about data sets. So I guess I should stop. Was there any questions about that? It's just a pretty way of doing JDBC stuff. It gets rid of a lot of the exception type code you'd see. The code that you'd need for working with the collections that come back tends to shrink down a lot, and you end up with nice, concise code and simple code to interact. Was there any questions? Yep. So the question was, can you manually do commits and so on? And yes, you can. So all of the features that are available to you at the JDBC level percolate their way up. And so you've got full control, and you can roll back. And
send commit, the method, send method.
Roll back, commit, and so on, yes.
Thanks.
Okay, so we're going to move up the stack now. So it turns out that even though we added this nice feature to Groovy that simplified JDBC a heck of a lot of the users of Groovy sort of said, well, actually, we don't ever want to see SQL again in our life. The whole reason why we're using, we came over to the world of programming because we didn't like that database 101 subject, and we don't like this. We'd like to not see SQL, and we'd like everything to look like the world of objects and so on. So if you were in the Java world and you had that particular concern, you might start looking at an object relational management systems, or Hibernate or whatever. And you can do that in Groovy as well. But what the dataset does is it provides, for simple cases, it provides you a poor man's ORM that makes databases just look like collections in memory. Okay, and that's what dataset's all about. It's got some smarts in it for lazy execution, but otherwise it's just, for simple scenarios, it just lets you create stuff and get on with the job. How do we do it? I can define athletes equals SQL.dataset. So SQL is the same Java SQL, Groovy SQL SQL class we looked at in the earlier slides. So if we just call, instead of calling .rows or .each row or whatever, I can call .dataset, give it a table name, and now I've got something back, which is, if you like, a smart handle on that table that lets me treat it as if it's an in-memory object, in-memory collection. So I can just go athletes.each, print them out, and I'll use the same syntax that I'd use as if it was an object in memory. So I'll just go it.firstname, because if I had a Java class, I'd have first name and so on as the property names or whatever. Okay, if I want to add a new method, I can just do an add, and this is a map variant, first name, last name, date of birth. Great, new row in the table, done, boom. Now I can print them out again, and you can see it's four in there now instead of three.
This is a table name, right?
Athlete is the table name, correct. Table name in my database. So there's no magic to conceptually it's as if I had an athlete class defined somewhere, but I haven't. Okay. But yeah, that's athlete is the table name. So that's if you look back in the slides, you'll see that's how we defined it. Okay, now I said this was a poor man's ORM. Now why did I say that? It only works if you've got a single table. So if I've got a query that spans across multiple tables, I'm out of luck, except if I create a view. Like before, we created a stored procedure to span between the athlete and the run table. Create yourself a view. In my case, I've created a view athlete run. It was in the previous slide where I had my DDL, but I didn't mention it. But it spans across those two tables. So now I can just go SQL.dataset past my view, and now I can print out last name and venue, for instance, on a particular, I've got a particular query that I've put in there. Okay, so it'll come back with two rows in my case. So runs.each, I'll print them out, and I've got the two world records from Kenuchi. Does that make sense? So it's really straightforward, isn't it? It's super simple. Okay, but that's not where the smart stuff happens. The smart stuff is happening because of the lazy execution that's available. So I go athletes dot find all. So athletes here is, I've gone, it's from the previous slide. It's my data set, athletes, SQL.dataset athlete, right? So I'm going athletes.findAll, where the first name is after P in the alphabet, or equal to P in the alphabet. I'm going to then find all rows in the database, in my in-memory view of the database, where the date of birth is after a certain date. Then I'm going to sort them by date of birth. Then I'm going to reverse the order of what came back. And this is just for our benefit. Don't ignore these two lines here, and I'll explain them in a minute. Then what I'm going to do is print out the first name for all the rows that came back. Now, how many queries do you think are happening to the database as I'm going along here? None. None happen until I actually try to do something, and at that point, one query goes to the database. So this is a smart layer that sits there. That's when I think I'm doing queries, it's just saying, oh yeah, you also have that condition. Oh, you also have that condition. Oh, you also have that condition. When you actually try to use it, so it's acting like a proxy. No one's called me. No one's tried to get my value yet. I'll just keep remembering stuff. As soon as someone tries to get the value out, it says, oh, all those things I've remembered, I better go and piece that together and call. And so you get a single query, select star from athlete, where first name's greater than that, and date of birth is greater than that, and order by date of birth, descending, and it passes in the parameters, and the query comes back. So you can go turn on that logging that I had before, and you'll see that just one query goes. Does that make sense? Okay, again, you've got to use views if you're wanting to make that sort of stuff happen across different databases. Okay, so that's the bulk of what I was trying to get across in the talk. I've now just wanted to show you a really whirlwind look at some other kinds of databases. So there's many different flavors of database, and many of these libraries actually have special groovy APIs to them and so on, which we'll see little glimpses of that. So the first thing I'm going to look at is MongoDB, which is a database-oriented, a document-oriented database. So has everyone seen NoSQL databases before? Everyone's seen all that sort of stuff? Yeah. Okay, I don't want to spend too long on this. I've only got a few minutes. A document-oriented database, instead of having a whole bunch of rows and fourth normal form and also highly optimizing the way the data is stored so that certain kinds of queries are really efficient, it just has blobs of data. Okay, and that makes some kinds of queries really inefficient, but other kinds of queries very efficient and so on. So there's advantages and disadvantages to these sorts of databases. My talk's not going to sell you on whether this is what you should be using or not, but if you do want to use it, it's very easy to do from Groovy. So there happens to be a Gmongo library that you can use. There is a Java Mongo library, and this is just a bit of syntactic sugar over the top. So I can go and create a new Gmongo database, and then I can clear it all out in case it's already exists, and then I can drop in a document, a blob, and I can, here I've just got a maps of information, nested information, and I can just drop that in, and it's a blob of stuff that happens to be a particular runner, and in this case, one run as well, and that's all thrown in as a blob, and then I can do query, I can wrap that up if I want, and have a helper method, add in some data using my help methods. You can see here I'm adding in another blob, but I've done it in such a way that I can keep the equivalent of what the foreign key information would be. It's a detail I don't need to go into today. And I can now add in a bunch of stuff. I can, if I want, add in a blob in JSON format or whatever. So there's facilities in this API for just getting a blob of JSON and throwing it into my table. Now I can do things like find out how many athletes are in my table, and I can do find all the athletes and print out information about them, and I can just step down into the runs and see how many there are and so on. So all the information about a particular runner and all their runs and everything's all in a blob, and that's a very handy thing for me to have for certain scenarios. some of the querying, I'm highlighting some of the querying capabilities here, but I haven't got time to go into the details. But all the kinds of things that you'd expect are supported. There's a special query notation as well over and above things that collection APIs will give you. The last thing I want to talk about is a little graph database. Neo4j, there's a few different ones around. I particularly like this one. You'd use this kind of database if you're particularly interested in the relationships between data. So in this, these are my athletes, these are my runs, but I've got some, it's the relationships between the data. So this particular world record supersedes this one, this supersedes this one. And that's, these are the edges of my graph, if you like. And when I'm interested in this information, that's when a graph database comes to its own, comes to the fore. There's certain kinds of queries in these kinds of databases that are orders of magnitude more efficient because of the way we've stored this information. Now, there's a whole lot of slides on how you do all of this. I've actually used Groovy's metaprogramming capabilities to make it look pretty. And we'll step forward and show you some examples. So I can just create nodes in my database here, and I can start inserting into them just by, once I've created a node, I can specify first, last, date of birth, and it's populating my database. And I can go athlete one in world record time, this marathon, and it's now created some edges. Now we can go step forward, and there's ways in which you can, I'm putting in more edges here, ways in which you can query the information that's in this database through a special graph API, if you like. And there is, in fact, some Groovy, there's a little Groovy DSL language that called Gremlin that's supplied that lets you query this whole graph of objects in a very succinct sort of way. Okay. And that just wraps it up to there. Okay, so that was a quick glimpse at Neo4j, which is a graph database. Wasn't trying to give you a tutorial on that, that's a big topic in itself. But we saw relational at the start. We saw two different, very, very different flavors of graph database, and you can find out more about them. And it just Groovy happens to be a nice way of interacting with all of those. Okay, thanks very much. I don't know if we've got time for a question or not, or I don't know. Up to you.
No more questions?
Okay. If you've got any questions, come and see me during the breaks. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice day and a nice con.